can really have a space. Society's first event of the year, and as you can already tell, we're starting off with a very special event. We have two great personalities joining us tonight for this discussion or interview. We have His Holiness Radhanath Swami, who's just stepped off the plane from America this morning, and we're very grateful to have him join us, especially after last year's success of SOAS that we might have come along to also hear him speak. Those of you that don't know Radhanath Swami, he has attracted worldwide respect for his work and character over the 40 years of service, so much so that he has crossed paths with notable personalities such as the Dalai Lama and Barack Obama. If any of you got the fly, you probably already know that. As the spiritual leader of the Krishna consciousness movement, he's also the driving force behind many social initiatives such as the Barshana Eye Camp and the Midday Meal Food Programme in Mumbai in India, which daily serves over 250,000 plates of food to the children of the slums of Mumbai. So those of you that have an idea about the food queue every day outside SOAS, kind of dwarfs that. And whilst in the UK for his brief tour, Radhanath Swami will be visiting Oxford and also Cambridge universities, among many other institutions, but we're graced to have him come here to SOAS first today, so that's very special. And we'd also just like to extend our gratitude to our very own Professor Chan, who will be hosting Radhanath Swami on our behalf and on SOAS's behalf, as well as sharing some words of wisdom himself tonight. Professor Chan, as some of you probably already know, he's been involved in philanthropic work in Africa for almost 30 years. In 2001, he established a foundation which assists young martial arts students across the continent, but specifically in Zambia and Zimbabwe. Along with this, he's balanced a very impressive academic output, and his presence has created a lot of excitement here today, so we're looking forward to hearing from both of you. And I'm just going to quickly run through the schedule of the event tonight, so everyone knows what to expect. Firstly, Radhanath Swami and Professor Chan are going to just share some of their realizations from their personal experience, just regarding the necessity of adopting spiritual consciousness and the tangible benefits that can be perceived on an individual, societal, and a worldwide level when this is achieved. And then after this, Professor Chan will begin the interview with Radhanath Swami, following on from these topics. And then after this, he will open up the forum to include you. So if anyone has any questions that they would like to put forward to Radhanath Swami, we encourage you to please take this opportunity, this rare opportunity. We don't actually have any microphones, so if you have a question, make sure you extend it to the whole auditorium. And then after this, that's when we serve the vegetarian feast just outside. And luckily, Radhanath Swami and Professor Chan have agreed to be available just at the front here for more one-on-one questions if anyone would like a... if they didn't get the opportunity during the forum, or they would like a more personal response, or would like to get one of Maharaj's autobiographies signed, then this is the perfect opportunity. And so I hope everyone enjoys the event tonight, and they can take something away from it. Everyone can just join me in welcoming Radhanath Swami and Professor Chan.
Om Mahyam to be done, thus Jnanan Janachalakaya Chakshurun Militam Jena Tasmai Sri Gurave Namaha Nama Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prestaya Bhutale Srimate Bhakti Vedanta Swami Nityanamine Namaste Saraswati Deve Gauravani Pracharine Nirvishesha Sunyavadi Paschajate Satharine Vanchakalpath Rupyascha Kripa Sindhu Yevacha Patithanam Pavanibhyo Vaishnavibhyo Namo Namaha Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Gadadhara Srivasati Gaur Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare
briefly on the subject of how spiritual life has a relevant importance within the modern world. It's incredible how things change. Today, with the various conflicts greed, sectarianism, pollution. It's a very exciting opportunity to really be instruments of powerful change. And from a spiritual perspective, that change, in order for it to be substantial, it has to begin within ourselves. Albert Einstein said that we cannot solve today's problems by using the same awareness that caused them. And this is an age-old challenge, how to actually change our consciousness. In the early days, thousands of years ago in India and other places, scriptures were sketched into palm leaves, and it was extremely rare to get something like that. And the only way people would learn is holy people would just walk along dusty pathways with a little bag of these palm leaves and go town to town, village to village, and teach people. That was the only access there was. And there was tremendous transformations in society. How things change. Just yesterday I was with my father. He's 89 years old. And he was telling me in his childhood there was no such thing as television. To make a phone call, you'd have to go to the corner drugstore and turn a crank. And then you get an operator and you tell her where you want to call. And for a local number, she would have to take a cord and push it into the hole where that phone number was. Just in one lifetime, what's happened to this world? Now with satellite TV, internet, with telecommunications, with cellular phones, it's absolutely incredible what technology has done. And this technology could be utilized for very, very positive purposes. But a serious question that I think we all have to really ask is there a need to step back and see what's really happening to the values of the human consciousness? I recently saw an article in a health journal which explained the number one cause now of injury-related deaths in America is suicide. It has actually gone beyond automobile accidents, which is number two. And number three is drug-related deaths. With all we have, depression, suicide, anxiety, and not long ago in Wall Street, there was such a trauma that affected the economies all over the world. And so much of it, the cause was greed. Greed by people who had everything materially that people could possibly dream of. They weren't satisfied. And in the global community we're living in today, even in the name of religion, which is supposed to actually solve these problems, it so often becomes the biggest problem because of sectarian conceptions, where spirituality, instead of cleaning the effects of arrogance, superiority complex, it becomes a weapon to serve the ego in the name of God. In the 1960s, when I was a student, like many of you, of course, I only made it through one semester of college before I took my journey to the East. Kind of never came back. But we had our challenges then. Pretty much the same as now, but just in different forms. In the 1960s, from Illinois near Chicago, there was tremendous social unrest because of civil rights. It just didn't make sense to me. My father was a struggling middle-class person who went through bankruptcy twice. But still, somehow or other, we had what we needed. But just a few miles away, in the ghettos of Chicago, people who had a different color skin, they were in poverty. And although the U.S. Constitution and all we learned in schools was teaching us that there's freedom and justice for all, there was no equal opportunity for such people. If you're born in the ghetto, it's 95% you will live and die in the ghetto. So much prejudice. Didn't make sense. And some of my best friends persecuted for that. Martin Luther King. In one speech he said that the irony of our times is we have guided missiles and misguided humanity. At the same time there was a Vietnam War going on, a war that really didn't make any sense whatsoever. But yet, when we turn 18, if we're drafted, we have two choices. Go to war or go to jail. It was serious. When things are really right in your face, you have to take it seriously. It's not just some ideology that you may not believe in that somebody else is dealing with. These were real factors. And so many of my brothers and sisters at that time, we were demonstrating. Some were killed, beaten by the police who were supposed to be protecting our freedom. It was a serious times. And in my own life, I just couldn't go along with such apparent contradiction and hypocrisy. So I joined the counterculture. But then, as time went on, I realized that the same disease that the counterculture was fighting against, we had it. We just had a different hairstyle and a different dress style and different music. And then I realized the only real solution has to be changing our own hearts. The world needs compassion. The world needs to see the universal spirit of how life is sacred in whatever form it takes. I remember once I was speaking to the Minister of the Environment for India, and she challenged me, Narendra Gandhi, "What are you holy people, you sadhus, doing for the environment? The rivers are polluted, the oceans are polluted, the earth is polluted, the air is polluted, and you're sitting around and chanting and meditating, praying. What are you doing?" He was an activist. I was actually very thrilled with his enthusiasm. And a little crowd was gathered around, just sitting at an airport, trying to mind my own business. And I expressed my thoughts that if we don't go to the root of a problem, and we only deal with the symptoms, well, we're not making a very lasting solution. It's like if there's boils in the body due to a blood disease. It's necessary that we deal with the boil by putting some salve and compress, whatever. But however many times we do that, there'll be more and more and more boils coming unless we go to the root cause, purifying the blood. So what is the root cause of all these problems in this world? The pollution of the air and the sky and the earth is simply a manifestation of the pollution within our hearts. Greed, arrogance, insatiable passions for power, for wealth, envy, anger, so many illusions. And universally, spirituality is meant to clean our hearts. My guru, Srila Prabhupada, used to say, spirituality, real religion, is not about being a Hindu or a Muslim, a Christian, a Jew, a Parsi, a Jain, a Sikh, a Muslim. It's about cleaning the heart. It's about building a true foundation within ourselves. foundation that we build our lives upon, a foundation of inner fulfillment, a foundation of compassion, a foundation of love for God. And sing the sacredness of life everywhere. Lord Chaitanya, one of our great avatars, he taught Amani Namanadena. And true culture is the capacity to offer honor and respect to the living force within every living being. To clean our hearts of this dirt. The explanation, Cheto Dharpana Marujanam Bhava Mahatma, that the mind is like a mirror. And if the mirror is covered with dust, we can't see ourselves. All we see is the dust. But if we clean the mirror, we see ourselves. Who are we? The Bhagavad Gita explains, Jayate Mriyate Bhagavad, that we are all living forces. We are all spiritual sparks. We're part of God. Seeing through the eyes and hearing through the ears and tasting through the tongue and thinking through the brain. And the nature of that living force is Satchidananda, eternal, full of knowledge and full of happiness. And that happiness, its essence, is love. To love and to be loved. And the origin of that love is the nature of the eternal soul's love for God. And when that love is awakened within ourselves, there's such deep fulfillment that we can actually see a part of God in everyone. And there's love. Human evolution is going beyond the obsessive need take things to finding the true pleasure of giving, seva, unselfish service. And when we develop that foundation by simply awakening this essence within ourselves, then our integrity will not be compromised by temptations or fear. Then we can actually see everything in relationship to the love we discover within ourselves. That's the principle of real spirituality. And that's the age-old universal solution if we actually follow our spirituality for that purpose. Gandhi said, be the change you want to see in the world. I'll just tell a little story. One time, I was sitting on the bank of a river Ganges, and this hawk, I'm thinking of this story because Professor Chan was just telling me about his visit to Ethiopia, where instead of seeing sparrows flying around at sunset, there's hundreds of eagles that are soaring through the air. And there was this very large hawk. His wings were expanded. Getting flying lower, lower, lower until he was just a few feet above my head. I was all alone. I was getting a little worried as I looked up, he had a really sharp beak. He was big, and I'm pretty small. Suddenly, kind of thinking, I'm kind of glad it's him instead of me. but I kind of transcended that human reaction. And I looked at that little fish, because it was only a few feet away from me, and his eyes were so bewildered. He was absolutely shocked at the fish. He was flapping and flapping in desperation. And the hawk took the fish higher and higher and went off into the forest. And I was thinking that fish was obviously just going about its day like any other day. Swimming upstream, downstream, probably with friends and family members, playing, looking for food, and whatever else fish is doing. So many fish means they think of other stuff too. Just going about its day, when suddenly the hawk of fate drifted out of its complacence. And then I was thinking, what a lesson that is to all of us. We read about it in newspapers, we see it on television. We learn about it from our friends and loved ones. How at any moment, things could change. We shouldn't be complacent. We should be alert. If that fish was swimming deeper, the hawk could not touch it. And similarly, if we go deeper into ourselves, if we develop that spiritual foundation that is inherent within all of us, then whatever may happen in the world, it cannot disturb our integrity, our dignity. It cannot disturb our peace and our love for all beings, for God. And that potential is within all of us. And in these modern days where there are so many problems ecologically, economically, in religions, on practically every level, the real revolution is a revolution within. In my own tradition, we chant God's names and try to live with character for the purpose of cleaning the mirror of our heart and going deeper and deeper and deeper. And students are the future of the world. And it's really the time when this internal revolution can have a powerful effect on us, our colleagues, and the world. We thank you very much.
Questions that always come to my mind is growing up, I've had been suddenly taken a wrong path in my life. Because we have many similarities of background. We're both children of the 60s. And we did the demonstrations of the 60s that I also was a street fighting man. The police and I did not get on very well at all. And I also took myself off to wander different parts of the world, eventually fetching up here in this country. But most of my early years, late 20s, throughout most of my 30s, I was involved in peacekeeping work in the conflicts of Africa. And it was only after that that I became an academic and eventually wound up here at SOAS. And I'm very much reminded of this not only because of continuing violence in not just Africa, but many countries in the world today, but just this last weekend, there was a very peculiar reunion of a number of people that I'd known when they too were younger. And these had been guerrilla fighters from various liberation struggles in Africa. And we all met at the Konrad Adenauer Villa in Lake Como. It was a special meeting arranged just so that these people could get together again. Many of them I've seen many, many years ago when they were still in camouflage fatigues, still fighting, still struggling for something, which probably left them very little time for spiritual fulfillment. And now they're all young ministers, ambassadors, and in a worldly sense would be regarded as very successful. And yet they're consumed by the struggles of trying to do something for their countries, consumed by an inner struggle of somehow keeping their integrity and not becoming corrupt, which is so easy to do in many of these situations. Some of them feel that they're being successful or on the path to success, and many of them are fully able to admit that they've been failures. But I'm wondering how one reconciles lives like that with the kinds of lives that we're talking about in terms of being able to dedicate ourselves, our consciousness, to polish the mirror of our minds and our hearts for the sake of inner peace, to spread the message, the whole ethos of non-corruption in the world, starting with ourselves. How possible it is, if you are involved in the great struggles of the world, to keep your mirror free of dust, not to mention free of so many other things. And I wanted to make these comments at the very beginning, to try to introduce some conversation precisely about this. The students here at SOAS come from 120 nationalities, and that's a pretty high percentage of nationalities for such a small university. And traditionally, there have always been, Swamiji, very much involved in the great issues of the day. They're idealistic. They want to become better people in exactly the way that you suggested, that each of us should try to become a better person. But they also want to become involved in the struggles of the world because they see injustice. And so the compassion that they direct upwards, I wonder to what extent that corrupts the possibility of development inwards. And I think that's a tension that all of us have to face in life. I think that one of the great things that I really, really admire about the Krishna consciousness people is precisely because, despite how many people view the Krishna consciousness people, and they're actually always involved in some kind of outward manifestation of trying to assist and to be very, very actively compassionate to others in the world. The example of the feeding people in immediate cities, hundreds of thousands of plates of food on a daily, if not millions on a weekly basis. That kind of outreach, I think, is vitally important. But is it possible to do that kind of outreach, that kind of compassionate outreach, when a situation is something which is almost certainly going to compromise you? I'm thinking of a particular assignment I had at the end of the Eritrean War for Liberation. There are two very, very moving experiences when I went to Eritrea to help with the reconstruction there. This was in the early 1990s. And you'll remember that Bob Geldof's Live Aid had taken place in 1984 with the great Ethiopian famine, which had affected not just Ethiopia, but Eritrea and very, very large parts of Sudan as well. And I was by the port city of Massawa, which had been totally destroyed by air attacks. There was no stone standing on a stone. It was just total devastation. And so I went to the Red Sea, feeling very, very depressed about all of this. And a young boy fell in step with me, and he spoke a bit of English and asked where I had come from. And I said, I'd come from England. And he said, ah, I hear that 8 years ago, when we had the great famine here, there was a singer in your country who tried to help us. We've got to be thinking about ways of trying to help. All of us know Bob Geldof is a loudmouth, sort of rabble-rousing, very bad-mannered, very bad rock musician. But all the same, did something very, very positive. trying to reach out to others. But in doing so, also compromised himself, I feel, in terms of the associations he made with the rich and the great and the powerful and the politically strong of the world. In order to try to help other people, he tried to get money and political support from those whom I would regard, and I think most of my students, as deeply compromised individuals. And that's a contradiction, I think, that has to be grappled with as we try to exercise compassion, a form of spiritual poverty in today's material world. How do we address that contradiction? The other thing that most alarmed me on that particular visit was I was taken to visit an execution ground where it was my job to count how many bodies were at that point in time still unburied. Don't forget the war had just come to an end. So I counted 600 bodies. And what alarmed me was not the bodies, but the counting of the bodies, but by how uncaring and jaded I'd become by the end of that exercise. And driving back up the hills to Asmara, the capital city of the mountains of Eritrea, I was asking myself very deep questions. Why do this? How can you do things like this and still maintain compassion? Or should you not do this and not risk losing your compassion in the first place? So Swamiji, I was wondering, given exactly the things that you're talking about, the violence in the world today, the great difficulties that plague young people all around the world, given the idealism that young people here at SOAS feel towards all of these things, what would you advise them to avoid being torn by trying to do something which will compromise their compassion? And how to keep their compassion? And is it possible to keep compassion by keeping aloof from the great struggles of the world? To what extent can you develop yourself as a compassionate and a spiritual human being while being involved in these struggles to try to do something better for other people in the world? I wonder whether I could start my interview by asking you a difficult question, but one which I'm sure resonates in the minds of one of my young friends here.
PhD student working on a thesis was interviewing my guru, Srila Prabhupada. And he was challenging the nature of the compassion of today's world. It was a long talk. But at one point, she tried to change the subject and said, could I ask you a philosophical question? And Prabhupada said that without good character, philosophy has little or no meaning whatsoever. At the beginning of humanity, really, true humanity is our character. Character means transformation from arrogance to humility, from greed to generosity, from hate to love, from vengeance to forgiveness. These are universal principles. And so often today, even the name of religion and high spiritual philosophy, there's very little character. The world needs this character. and for their character to actually be able to withstand the temptations and the fears that will inevitably come to us, we need a strong internal foundation. And that's where the need for spiritual life is. But at the same time, especially in modern times, the greatest service that we can do, and the greatest, and one of the greatest purifications for our own self, is to be an activist, to be willing to take risks, to be willing to actually extend ourselves as instruments of compassion, of instruments of change. So I would say, Professor Chan, that balance is required. The balance of activism within the world, and at the same time, that cultivation of the inner strength, the inner integrity, and ultimately connecting with that grace. That grace that is beyond our own intelligence and beyond our own powers, to be instruments of peace and love. Just like when we work, somehow or other we find time to eat, or we have time to sleep. Because if we don't do that, we're not going to be able to do our work much better. If we think that if we just eat and sleep and don't do any work, and that's not very progressive. And if you just do work and think that, you know, eating and sleeping is just a waste of time, what is going to be our sustenance? So to harmonize the activism of our service to this world with that internal cultivation of virtue, it's what really the world needs, and what each of us could choose to live by.
Swamiji, how should we do this? I'm thinking about a talk I heard once by the Chinese film director Han Li. He made the film Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, which was a very didactic film, and a very, very unusual one for its time. But he was asked what his philosophy was like. He said he was a Taoist, a Chinese form of meditation and development very closely aligned with nature. But he said that it's time that we were able to develop in today's world an industrial Tao. That is no use learning to meditate in mountains and by streams if we no longer relate to the environment that most people have to live in. And that to be spiritual, and to be spiritual and meaningful, that is meaningful to other people way today, you have to have an industrial Tao. So the question that comes to mind is trying to cultivate oneself and trying to find this balance that we were talking about. What about the temptation? This is in fact a temptation to remove ourselves from the scene of action, to take ourselves to a peaceful place, far away from where anything troublesome or difficult might happen. Is there a way to be able to develop an industrial spirituality, as it were, in today's very, very difficult and industrial world?
Technology, science, the products of industry are actually neutral. Their benefit or their destructive powers depend on our consciousness. An example is given of a knife. Is a knife good or bad? If it's in the hands of a thief, that thief will kill someone to get money. If the same knife is in the hands of a surgeon, that knife will save somebody's life. So the things of this world, whatever they may be, their value is in the consciousness of who's using. I remember when I was writing this book, The Journey Home, I wanted to go back into some of the places I lived 35 years before to get a view of memories. So I went up to the Himalayan jungles, just north of Rishikesh, where I lived with one yogi in a cave, in a deep jungle. So I went to the cave, and found there was about four or five little caves and one big one. And I was a student, so I lived in one of the little ones. And the guru lived in a big one. They were nice caves. His cave was a 5-star cave. Mine's for like 2 stars. But I went to the cave, and it was boarded off. And there was a big lock on it. And it said, "Trespassers will be prosecuted." This was very different. So I was just kind of sitting there wondering what happened. And then this one yogi, long matted hair, just had one little strip of cloth around his loins, his barefoot. It's a real traditional looking yogi. He came to me and said, "You're not allowed in this cave." I said, I understand. I said, "Why?" And he explained that the government forest department evicted all the yogis from their caves because they want to develop it for tourism. So all these yogis were evicted. And there was a court case. And then he looked at me and said, "But do you want to see my cave?" And I said, "Yeah." So he's starting, he's barefoot, and he's elderly man, but he's just jumping all over these mountains, and I'm climbing up with him. I had somebody with me who could translate. And he had a really nice cave. Little altar, little fire pit for a sacred fire. Everything was there. And outside of his cave, he had a disciple constantly reading the Bhagavad Gita out loud. And he was showing me around. And I asked him, "How is it that you're allowed to live in your cave when everybody else was evicted?" He told me that he made a deal with the government. That he's an informer. That he every day spends a couple hours walking through the jungle, and if any other yogi tries to live in any cave, he informs the government and they go and arrest him. And for that service, he's allowed to stay in the cave. So I was thinking, this is interesting. And then I went to the main disciple of this person who I used to live with, and I asked him, "Where is our guru? Where is your guru?" And he said that years ago, he was starting to get popular, and people were coming through the jungle to see him. And there was another yogi in another cave who couldn't tolerate people coming to see this person instead of him. So one day, when this yogi, who was getting popular, was taking water from a string, the other yogi shot him in the back and killed him. It's yogis. Politics are not yogis. And when I was talking to this disciple, he was in a government guest house, which was, he was living in a jungle cave, and now he's in this government guest house in a storage room. And he was just sitting on a wooden bed, and all around him was piles and piles and piles of stuff, blankets and pots, and it was just stuff. And I asked him, "What is all this stuff?" And he said that all the other caves who got evicted they all brought all their stuff and put them in this room. And I said, well, why do you have this room? And he said, because I'm fighting the Forest Department in the courts. And I have a lawyer. And the lawyer told me that, you know, I have to be prepared to go to court whenever the dates are there. And I saw there was all kinds of people from America and Germany and Israel and Ireland and England in this hotel, and they were playing music and they were doing it. This poor yogi sitting there. And all of a sudden I heard this music. You know, I'm from the 60s, I'm not used to some of this modern music. And I've kind of lived in caves for a long time myself. It was like this. It was very loud. And I was thinking, this poor yogi, he was living with, you know, to the sounds of birds and crickets and owls. And it just kept going. And I was thinking, you know, to find a court case is here. And as the music was blaring, he reached over into this room full of stuff. Do you like this story? And he picked up an old burlap bag with a rope on the top of it and untied it. Then he reached in the bag, and it was this plastic bag. It was really old and shriveled up, and it was knotted on the top. And he untied it, and meanwhile, and he reached in the bag and pulled out a cell phone. And he put it to his ear and answered, Om Namah Shivaya. It was his lawyer. And I asked him, you know, why do you have that ringer on your cell phone? And he said, the person who gave me the cell phone was my lawyer. He was from Delhi. And he said, there's a menu of different types of ringers. What would you like? He was going through the list, and he came to the selection trance. And the yogi said, that is the goal of yoga, trance. So he said it and left. And after he was gone, he didn't realize what trance music actually was. But anyways, I'm sorry for the long answer, but even if you're living in the caves of the Himalayas, still, envy and greed and all of this stuff could be there, even violence. And I know people in New York City and London and Bombay who have families, who work in business, who are very, very pure, safe people. So our spirituality is not so much a matter of changing our location, it's a matter of changing our hearts. Because there's disturbance everywhere.
I think that was a very, very fantastic answer. Apologies, we understand that in today's music there's something called bass rapping, which means that you manipulate the microphone to make exactly the kinds of noises that you were just making. So I could get you a very good commercial lawyer. Ladies and gentlemen, I think that what we should do right now is to open the floor to you. And if you've got any questions that you want to ask Swamiji, you should feel very, very free to ask your questions. Can I have some hands of anybody who wants to start the ball rolling? The gentleman at the back there.
I was just wondering the extent to which there was any virtue in someone who does choose to go out and not have any relevance with what we're calling the industrialized world, and actually just go out and live entirely in a cave, not to transform themselves and come back and do good, but to stay out and die like that. I'm just wondering, is there any virtue in doing that?
According to our Vedic tradition, there's two types of serious spiritual practitioners. One is a bhajananandi, which is a person who withdraws from the world so that he or she, in a holy place, in a monastery or ashram, is completely away from the greed and the competition and the egoism of the world, to give their lives only to prayer, to chanting God's names, and to spiritual practice in that way. Of course, sometimes the same types of problems in a micro setting are there too. I've seen in ashrams and monasteries, usually people have to deal with the same kind of stuff in principle as we're dealing with in the city, just in another dress. But that's a bhajan anandi. And some people just go off alone. And such persons, if they do it right, can actually attain that love of God, that liberation. And the other type of person is a ghosti anandi, a person who makes that balance of giving proper time each day to one's own spiritual practice to actually connect with that grace, with that power, foundation in ourselves, and then to go out and save up, unselfish service, whether we're a doctor or a lawyer or a professor, or whether we're a swami or an industrialist or a business person or a software engineer, to actually perform our duty as an expression of that grace that we're connecting with inside, rather than just an obsession to get so many external things to try to satisfy the emptiness within myself. So these are two things. In the world today, we need ghosti anandis to help as instruments of compassion.
The young lady in the center.
Me? I wanted to ask you, what do you suggest to us to understand which path we should take among these two?
Among the two?
Well, you just said like there are different kind of way of expressing the spiritual connection. So, if you can suggest us how to find our special one.
If we are sincere, and we associate with people who are sincere, that is revealed to us. But to be in this world but not of this world, in many ways is more difficult, but in many ways it's more practical and congenial to most people.
Yes.
In the first part, when you were saying that we should dig to our core and find God, and then and then have love for others, I was just wondering: are you saying that if we're not religious, we're not capable of the purest form of love? Is that your point or not?
If we don't connect to the eternal nature of our true self, our soul, and if we don't really connect to the grace of God, which is within all of us, which is that deepest, highest power of love, then we're not living according to our potential. To be good, to be kind, to be nice on a relative level is piety. Goodness, which is good, and to actually go deeper, where we can actually be instruments of that eternal nature of love, that takes spiritual purification. So it's a question of how deep we want to go. In our tradition, we chant these names of God for this purpose, to make that connection. We have this mantra, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. There are many mantras. Man means the mind, and Trayate or Tra means to liberate, to purify the mind. to get the dust off the mirror of the mind. And this Maha Mantra, and there are many names of God, it actually connects us to that deep and growing spiritual essence of the one of love that is our true nature. And that empowers us in a way that is beyond time and beyond death. And whether we call it, because religion is sometimes so misunderstood in this world, but the actual Latin word religion comes from the word religio, which means to bind us back to our essence. And the word yoga means to reconnect us, to reunite us with our essence. So what's important, whether we call it yoga or religion or spirituality, what's important is that we're reconnecting with our essence. And being empowered by that grace, whatever we may be doing. Janavi Devi, she's a beautiful, virtual soul, violin player, dancer, and singer. And she, the beautiful skills she has, tries to uplift people's consciousness without expecting anything in return. It's just beautiful. Whatever talents we have can be beautiful ornaments to our devotion. Does that answer your question?
We have another question just here.
Yeah,
maybe. Yes, I was just wondering, if spirituality is within all of us, and it's sort of and it's our essence in a way, is it possible that that some people could be unspiritual? Because there are some people, if you ask them, do you believe in anything, or do you have some form of spirituality, they'll say no. And do you think that's
possible,
that maybe they're just people who are not spiritual?
But
it's a question I ask.
There's people who are forgetful of their spirituality. And spiritual paths are to remind us of what we've forgotten. My beloved guru, Srila Prabhupada, when he first came to England, he was asked, why have you come here? We have our culture, we have our religion, why have you come here? And Srila Prabhupada replied that you British people, you controlled India for almost 2 centuries. And you practically all the treasures of India you took to England. He said, but the greatest treasure of India is its spiritual culture. And you forgot to take that back to England. So I've come to give to you what you forgot to take from us.
We have time for one more question, but we've had quite a number of young ladies, so we'll have this young gentleman.
My favorite quote is, to be yourself in the world that's constantly trying to make you into something else is the greatest accomplishment. I was just wondering, how would you define the words, to be yourself?
All the questions are beautiful. We have various levels of selves. This body is ourself. Yes? But it's ever changing. After one time you're a little baby, and now you're a very different body than your baby. And then the mind is a self, our thinking process. When you're a baby, you're thinking of the milk of your mother. When was the last time you thought of the milk of your mother? So now your mind is very much different. So it's always changing. So that's another self, the body, the mind. And there's also the witness that's actually experiencing life through all the changes of the body and mind. And that's the Atma. Atma means the eternal self, the true self. And to actually understand ourself in that way is the highest truth. And the world around us could facilitate living by those, by that virtue, assist us in finding our true self. In a highly elevated culture or society, you know, the way we do business, the way we do governments, the way we raise our families, it actually is in pursuance of living in harmony with our true self, with God. But unfortunately, so often in this world, you know, for the purpose of profit and power and whatever else, there's so many ways we're trying to be exploited, discriminated, and taken away from it, distracted from it. Last year I did a similar conversation as with Professor Chan. I did with Dr. Cornel West at Princeton University. And he said something that I really liked. He said, today's world, we are constantly being bombarded by weapons of mass distraction. We're being distracted. But as the Bible says, to live in this world, but not of this world, means to cultivate an awareness and help each other to cultivate that awareness of who our true self is. And then live within this world with those values. And that is an activism that can make great change. And we all have that opportunity. Because real happiness is the life of fulfillment. And fulfillment comes when we're really living the values that we hold sacred.
Ladies and gentlemen, Swamiji, whenever he travels, enjoys most when he's able to have one-on-one conversations with people who've come to speak to him and speak with him and to share experiences with him. And so it's been very, very important to ensure that there is some one-on-one time for you, both here at the front of the Lecture Theater and a little bit later on with the food and the other refreshment that's out there in the foyer. So what I want to do now is to bring this formal part of the proceedings to a close so that the informal interaction can begin. But before we do that, I think that we should show our appreciation to Swamiji for coming to talk to us.
The guests joining us tonight. I hope everyone had an amazing time. It was really quite enlightening for me, and hopefully for everyone else as well. And I hope everyone goes away with something to contemplate. And if you didn't manage to ask a question during the forum, we'd like to speak to Bhadana Swami or Professor Chan now that they've kindly given us a chance to be here for a little while longer during the evening. So if you'd like to come up and we'll just form kind of some of you might have seen the books that we were displaying just outside before you came in. I'm also just setting up another table here, and they're actually Bhadana Swami's autobiography. So if you like the hearing about his journey and his stories, and you'd like to experience more of his intimate realizations, then you can just purchase a copy for just a small contribution. We've done a special student price tonight. We've subsidised it for the unit, so it's just £8 for a copy tonight. And if you'd like to also get it signed by Bhadana Swami, this is probably the best and only opportunity you'll ever get. So be sure to pick up a copy. It's a truly amazing book. And I hope you won't mind, Arjun, we just took Stephen Chan's reference for the book just off the website quickly, so I'll just read it out to you. might sound quite eerie for Professor Chandler. This is what he said about the book. I greatly enjoyed this book. It shows how a man of great spiritual energy can start his adult life as a typical young rock and roller and open up his heart, mind and soul to great adventures and very great learning. The journey of Ratnaswami is an inspiring and humanly touching one. Throughout this book, the reader never loses the impression that he is one of us. Unlike other holy men, he is not posturing as one step removed. He is teaching us because he remembers how it is to be one of us. That is why the book is touching, because he himself has remained within close touching distance. We feel it is possible to take this journey. So that's just one reference. If you need any more, and they're on the back of the book. And also, I'd just like to take this great opportunity to let you know of the regular events that the Krishna Consciousness Society will be running this year. So on Mondays, we have yoga. And then on Tuesdays, we have philosophical discussions on the Bhagavad Gita, which is the basis of the spiritual teachings of which Ratnaswami was mentioning this evening. And then finally, on Thursdays, we have a guided music meditation. And all of these events are in room 116, which is just in the main building, right above reception. And they start at 6 o'clock, and all followed by a free vegetarian feast as well, like you've enjoyed tonight. And if you would like details on these events and you haven't signed up already, then please do sign up on our email list, which is just outside before you get the food. You'll have a little queue and just jot your name down. And then we'll send you all the information for the events. And also other events we'll be having, such as guest speakers, vegetarian group workshops, and also retreats at a spiritual centre within the London area. And if you had a nice experience here with Ratnaswami, please, and you would like to have his association again while he's briefly here in the UK, then there's one more public event this Saturday, just off Beach Street. And it's an evening of blissful music, mantra and meditation. And the details also are just outside on the table, the book table, and then we'll have details of the flyers and then the food. And Ratnaswami will also be running a retreat when he returns in March. So this is if you would like the opportunity to get away from the stress of university and the city just before exam period, then this is an extremely valuable opportunity for you. So please, again, sign up outside. There's a lot of places to sign, but hopefully you'll get the right one. And so, yeah. That was it. So if everyone would just like to possibly just create a queue going up this side, around and then out, and then just you can serve the food. And please feel free to come back in here and eat. And or there's a few seats just dotted around outside you can take. And for those of you that would like to come and speak to Ratnaswami or Professor Chan, then don't worry about food. We're saving some.